From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss the refugee and migrant camp near Calais, France, known as the Jungle, and this year's record number of refugee deaths in the Mediterranean.
Fewer people trying, more deaths, which would indicate that it's becoming more and more dangerous to do this. There does not seem to be any easy solution.
Then Rebecca talks with political scientist Paul Diehl. His latest book explores the evolution of peace in the international system.
It isn't just that there's the absence of war, but in the most peaceful relationships, war and violence is unthinkable.
They'll also discuss the politics of global governance. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about an issue we talk about often, the refugee crisis going on around the world. Unfortunately, we've hit record numbers this week. The deaths of those trying to cross the Mediterranean and reach Europe, those fleeing various parts of the world, but you know, the Middle East and Northern Africa, whatever it is, but they're dying in record numbers now, and so what are we to make of this? I mean, what is the response around Europe and elsewhere to this growing problem in the Mediterranean?
Well, there is an ounce of good news, if we can call it good news. The numbers of people trying to make the voyage has actually gone down. Last year, it topped out at over 1 million. This year, so far, it's somewhere around 600 or so thousand. But as you said, the number of deaths just exceeded last year's total. And so fewer people trying, more deaths, which would indicate that it's becoming more and more dangerous to do this. There does not seem to be any easy solution. The European Union, Europe in general, is trying to deal with this. Most of the people are obviously heading in that direction, many of them trying to get to places like Germany, Sweden, where economic opportunity is thought to be more more available, though even in those locales, they're having trouble there. So what is the answer? Well, right now, Europe is taking, or different countries within Europe are taking different numbers of the refugees and migrants. There's also been a push to have agreements between some of the individual countries and some of the countries of origin. So Italy, for example, recently signed an agreement with Sudan to help Sudan out, and in response, they will send some of the Sudanese people back. And they have actually started doing this. This is one of the first times where we're seeing a large repatriation of people. There are some significant human rights issues to consider in that, though, because Sudan is in a conflict zone. Their president has been wanted or indicted by the International Criminal Court. So some significant questions there. Also, the European Union signed an agreement with Turkey in the spring to kind of ease tensions there, and that has also raised some significant questions regarding what has happened to Turkey in the last 6 months or so. Just a lot of unanswered questions. And as we try to deal with this, as the European Union tries to deal with this, thousands more are trying to make the trek.
Well, on a related note, what we also saw happen this week was the destruction of a refugee camp in France, in the northern part of France, in Calais, where it was known as the Jungle. It was a camp that had come to represent all of the things that one might be concerned about camps. They're, you know, a terrible place to be in many ways, but yet full of children and others who have no other place to go. And so the French authorities have destroyed the camp, or are destroying in the process of destroying the camp. There was some resistance to this. There were some really terrible images coming out of that situation. So again, it's like the struggle continues. The human rights abuses and concerns continue. We obviously have concerns about security and law enforcement and that sort of thing in these camps and because of the refugee and migrant crisis. But, you know, where's the balance here? We've got you know, concerns about Islamic fundamentalist terrorists. I mean, that's what at least they're being called here in our own state. And those refugees being terrorists, we understand that. France has obviously been struggling with this. But these are human beings, too. There are human beings being caught up in this. So where is the balance? How and where are we going to find this balance?
hundreds of thousands, millions of human beings, children in many cases, unaccompanied minors, which is the big issue in response to the Calais closing, that there were a number of unaccompanied minors. So whereas many of the other refugees are in theory being put in other centers, they don't know yet what to do with the unaccompanied minors. This was a significant camp because these people represented, or most of them were hoping to get to the UK. And in large part, it's being closed down because that channel has been closed off in many ways, more closed off than it's been because of the Brexit vote and some other things that are happening in that country. But it's hard to say, yes, there is the possibility for radicalization in these camps. Yes, there's the possibility of ISIS soldiers coming across. But there is no better way to radicalize than to put people in a situation where they are prone to being radicalized and where they become disenfranchised. And so this is it's an ongoing difficult cycle, and they're really hard to know what the answer is. But we have to remember they are people. These are human rights issues here.
Ongoing problem for sure. Rebecca, we will return to this undoubtedly. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
If you have any thoughts about this discussion, let us know in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. You can also follow us on social media. Check us out on KGOU's Facebook page, or you can send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. You can get in touch with me directly at Suzek Rolat. Coming up, Rebecca will talk with Paul Diehl. He's a political scientist at the University of Texas at Dallas who studies war, United Nations peacekeeping, and international law. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Our guest this half hour is University of Texas at Dallas political scientist Paul Diehl. He's written dozens of books on international conflict, law, and peacekeeping. He spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Paul Diehl, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you.
Well, you are a scholar looking at issues of war and peace. And maybe just to start out, I think this definition of peace would be interesting to explore just a little bit. Is peace simply the absence of war, or is there a broader definition that we should be thinking of?
Yeah, I think that most people think of peace as the absence of war. And when they talk about peace agreements ending a civil war, that's what they mean. But in some of my most recent research, we think of peace is the absence of war is negative peace is really just a starting point, and that there are other kinds of forms of peace that bring in greater cooperation, integration across states. Even other kind of definitions refer to justice, economic development, those kinds of things. So I think it's useful to think of a broader definition of peace, because the alternative is you start lumping things together, such as the U.S. and North Korean relationship with that between France and Germany. Neither of them are with war, but we wouldn't characterize those as the same or belonging in the same category.
So it's really a process. It's not simply the cessation of conflict. It is almost a building process.
Yeah, the cessation of conflict or hostility is really almost a prerequisite. And most relationships in the world fall into that category of negative peace. But a smaller set of those, and the ones we often aspire to, such as between the U.S. and Canada, go far beyond that. And it isn't just that there's the absence of war, but in the most peaceful relationships, war and violence is unthinkable.
Well, and you mentioned the U.S. and Canada, a very friendly relationship, very hard to attain. There are other situations where there are perhaps third parties that are involved. So you've done a lot of research on mediation and how third parties can help build this more positive peace. If you can maybe talk a little bit about that and which third parties you're talking about or who's most effective.
It almost really depends on the context for things like that. I think third parties, for the most part, can't force peace, even negative peace, on two warring sides. And I think you see some of that illustration in Syria on the limits of even two of the most powerful states in the world getting many of their allies or surrogates to stop. I think when we talk about mediation, that's something different as a third party. And I think mediators can play an important role in helping parties to come to peace, like they say about the psychology patients, they have to want to change. Mediators provide the communication channels and the negotiations that will help facilitate the peace, and stronger mediators can provide carrots and sticks that change some of the cost-benefit analysis to those involved and make them more likely to come to an agreement. And once there's an agreement, it's often those third parties who can guarantee that agreement. So imagine that you had some type of ceasefire that occurs in maybe Syria or someplace else. It may be that that third party is the one who provides some assurance or guarantee that they're going to be followed, because almost by definition, the warring parties aren't going to trust each other to keep the agreement.
Of course.
You need some type of third party guarantee.
So these third parties, in most cases, they would be states, or would you suggest organizations? I know you've studied the UN quite a bit. Is that a role that the UN can successfully play?
They have in the past in a number of cases. The UN often appoints a special representative to do that. The advantage of either a UN mediator or someone from the European Union is they're often perceived as more legitimate than a state and considered oftentimes more neutral or less interested involved in that. That's the advantage. The disadvantage is when you move into having UN representatives is they don't necessarily have the political clout or the resources to provide those kinds of carrots and sticks. So, you know, it's something kind of a trade-off. The UN has been successful in achieving ceasefires, facilitating elections as far back as Cambodia in the late 1980s. But on the other cases, you know, they've been repeatedly unsuccessful in the Middle East between Israel and her neighbors, largely because Israel doesn't trust them. But there's a UN guarantee is not very meaningful to either side. It takes a superpower like the United States to be able to pressure both sides and to deliver on a commitment.
What might those sticks and carrots be? What might be some examples?
Well, in one case, is the carrots would be oftentimes financial aid that goes with that. So in some of the agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, the U.S. had promised Israel additional military aid and provides economic aid to the Palestinian Authority and things like that. So, you know, those are the things. If you sign the agreement, if you do this, we will provide that. The carrots often come in the form of sanctions or withholding carrots or not giving carrots for that. So those can be kind of economic kinds of sanctions, withholding kinds of military aid, not giving political kind of support, things like that, to be able to do that. I think those are often not quite as effective as the others. And if you're going to, for example, the United States is going to threaten Israel that it will reduce aid if it doesn't stop settlements in the occupied territories, well, first of all, Israel has to see that that's enough to change its behavior, and second, it actually has to believe the U.S. will do that.
Right, because there are domestic concerns
there are other kind
involved.
Of things,
yes,
that, that would require acts of Congress on the yearly foreign aid budget and other kind of political implications that go with that.
Our guest is Paul Diehl, a political scientist at the University of Texas at Dallas. More of his conversation with Rebecca Cruz right after a short break. I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest this half hour is University of Texas at Dallas political scientist Paul Diehl. He's been talking about international conflict and peacekeeping with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
You mentioned Syria, and as we know, in recent weeks, months, Russia and the United States have attempted to get involved, to serve as third parties, to serve as be mediators on some level. I suppose that we still don't know if this has been successful, but what tactics have they taken, and what should they be doing?
Well, what's a little bit odd is you actually have the United States negotiating with Russia to try and influence the behavior of all the other parties in the Syrian conflict. And so, one can be assured that I think the U.S. and the Russia will coordinate according to the agreement, won't bomb certain areas, take certain kinds of actions. But I said the odd thing is we're depending on Russia to deliver the cooperation and the behavior of the Syrian government. And Russia is depending on the United States to have various rebel groups also follow the kind of, the ceasefire in the given areas.
So you have your mediators actually trying to mediate each other.
I'm not even sure kind of a mediator, because usually you think of a third party between two sides. U.S. and Russia are really not what we call third parties, but primary parties, because they're actively involved in the conflict. Russian military is there, and the U.S. is close with special forces and providing aid to the rebels. So it's, like I said, it's a very odd situation of as if they're negotiating for other, you know, the groups that, that they support. And then you have others like ISIS who, you know, are supported by neither or not part of the negotiations and aren't really even covered by the ceasefire.
So that was another question I was going to ask you. We're talking about Russia, the United States, you mentioned earlier, Canada, France. These are state actors.
Yes.
And we've talked about kind of IGOs, the UN, the European Union. What about the non-state actors? What about your terrorist organizations? ISIS comes to mind, but also the recent agreement that Cuba brokered between the FARC and Colombia. Yeah. What role can mediation or third-party actors bring when we're dealing with non-state actors?
Yeah, I still think that they can. A lot of the you know, the peace agreements that take place in a civil war kind of context, state actors as well as international organizations, I think, can play kind of important roles. It's often behind the scenes, but I think the third parties you're talking about in those contexts are not necessarily going to be, as mediators, are not non-governmental organizations such as humanitarian relief agencies or others, because their role is more in the implementation of a peace agreement than facilitating it to kind of begin with. You know, but to me, it isn't the identity of the mediator that makes making it with non-state actors and coming to an agreement difficult. The difficulty is, in many civil war contexts, is you have multiple actors. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you don't have them all at the table or all part of the agreement, you have those who are outside of that and potential spoilers. And even in non-state actors are not like national militaries where there's strong command and control over the actions of a traditional military unit. In many of these rebel groups are made up of, you know, 15 to 20-year-old boys who aren't necessarily under the full control of the commanders. So even if you had the commanders of a given rebel organization, the degree to which they can stop the kind of violence that's taking place by those who are acting under their name is much more limited than if you have a traditional military and a leader or a general orders them not to take certain actions or to move out of kind of an area. So it's a much more difficult kind of context to get all the right folks to the table, get them to agree, and then finally to implement the agreement. And each of those three steps, you know, are fraught with perils.
How do you get them to the table? You said they have to agree, they want there to be peace. Yeah. There's also this confusion about, you know, who represents who and getting right. people to follow. What sort of recourse is there short of what's been tried?
Yeah, right. I mean, getting them to the table, political pressure from third parties can work. But, of course, just getting them to the table doesn't get you an agreement.
Sure.
I think those who study the process of starting negotiations and assuming that the parties are sincere about coming to a peace agreement find that it's most common in protracted conflicts where each side sees that there is what we refer to as a hurting stalemate, is neither side can win at the point and is incurring lots of different kinds of costs. And to move beyond that, if you have that kind of situation where you have a stalemate, you can see some of that in Syria and elsewhere, where neither side looks like it can win, you have the potential there. But the negotiations have to offer a potential agreement that provides a way out for the particular parties involved. And I think that's the kind of incentive to at least get them to talk. But then the hard parts come about, you know, what would the agreement look like? Who's going to guarantee it?
And what's it going to look like 5, 10, 15 years later? I mean, I think that's the other question. How do you maintain the momentum if we're thinking of peace as a long-term project?
Right.
Your third-party actors, whoever they may be, often are much more interested with go in, try to resolve, right. go out. And in my mind, I'm thinking of the Balkans in this
yes,
instance,
yes.
Where we were very involved. The United States was very involved in international organizations where there is no violence there, or the conflict there has subsided, but there are certainly a number of issues that remain.
Yeah, there's not necessarily in the aftermath of the former Yugoslavia what I would term as positive peace
right.
in there. You have had a lot of the refugees and others repatriated and resettled, but But many cases, they haven't gone back to their original villages and cities. They've gone to areas which are much more homogenous in terms of ethnicity and things like that. And you have within Bosnia-Herzegovina, essentially two sub-states, one by the Serbs and one by the Bosnian Muslims that operate kind of almost independently with an extremely weak kind of national government.
Perhaps laying the groundwork for future conflict.
It's certainly better than people killing each other
in
genocide, but it falls short of the kind of aspirations they had for putting that country back together.
So third parties that want to be involved have to think more holistically, have to think more long-term, and that's a hard sell.
That is. And there's lots of other factors that can happen kind of, in the long term. I also often don't think that when it comes time to stopping a civil war, that most leaders and negotiators think necessarily about what those long term arrangements are. I think their main priority is perhaps it should be is stopping the fighting. And then most of what you can put in a peace agreement are provisions that deal with the short term, which may be the disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of rebel forces. It may be the scheduling of elections within a reasonable period of time, and it may be other kind of short-term kind of security arrangements. But, it's difficult to project out 5 or 10 years and build, conditions which you never may reach, into any other kind of peace agreement. I mean, first of all, they're hard to envision, but second, they may also be complicated in getting to the initial agreement if you try and put too much into a peace agreement.
Absolutely. Well, I think complicated is definitely the word here, but we will continue to watch and see what happens in the former Yugoslavia and certainly what happens in Syria as we're 5 years into a civil war there. And we will see if the third party actors can get it together and maybe some sort of peace or at least a cessation will occur. So thank you so much, Paul, for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Glad to do it.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with University of Texas at Dallas political scientist Paul Diehl. We have a link to more information about his work on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaboration between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Katie Holland researches our interviews, Audra Bruls prepares our digital content, and Sam Dupre and Brian Hardzinski produce the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorelott.